Oh No, Not Again, by Dave Stone. Hi, Dave here. Speaking for the purposes of preamble to the following. Though, strictly speaking, of course, preamble to the following is something of a redundancy. Redundancy being the bane of a distressing number of lives in this world, and certainly in mine. But that's another subject entirely. In any case, some may have wondered, if only vaguely, about my precipitous departure from the elite cadre of individuals charged with the meticulous detailing of the various lives and times of one Bernice Surprise Summerfield. Multifarious though the avenues of speculation might be on the matter, the truth of things could not be simpler. I was on the run from an international league of assassins. Around a decade ago, I came home from my unpaid, I might add, thank you very much, volunteer work bandaging broken heads at the local orphanage to find my luxury penthouse apartment suite in the process of being ransacked. The culprit was a strikingly beautiful woman of athletic frame, dark complexion, and in a form-fitting suit of vulcanized rubber and patent leather. She pushed her sequined black velvet domino mask up to her partially cropped, if otherwise immaculately coiffured, hairline, the better to examine my quite extensive collection of Fabergé Christmas crackers, a supplementary line to the famous Easter eggs, quite priceless, and long since thought by many to have been lost to the ages, and in the spilled light from the penlight torch held between her perfect teeth, I recognised her instantly, as anybody would. It was the notorious, mysterious, industrial espionage operative, cat burglar and globe-trotting woman of secrecy, Chastity Dare. And, given her world-famous prowess in super-secret and discreet cat burglarizing, it struck me as a little odd and not to mention inconsiderate of her to have simply ransacked the frigging place. As it turned out, however, she hadn't. As it turned out, she explained, my chronicles of the lives and times of Bernie Summerfield had, in certain unfortunate particulars, rung a number of alarm bells in the futurity department of the dreaded Matraxis Breed Consortium. Yes, that Matraxis Breed Consortium. And the things that lived up in the tenebrous dampness of the reticulated escutcheon chamber had decided that I must be silenced. To this end, as Chastity Dare further explained, she had been contracted to break into my luxury penthouse apartment suite and plant evidence framing me for a crime I had not committed. Fortunately, however, for all concerned, even a cursory glance at my background file had informed her that I was one of the most decent, honest, kind, generous, and genuinely heroic and noble men who ever lived. And so, obviously, she had resolved to renege on the contract and break into my luxury penthouse apartments to warn me of the peril I was in instead. Only to find that, in accordance with some subsidiary plan, a squad of heavily armed, cyber-enhanced goons had ransacked the place in search of my more incendiary and irreplaceable Summerfield-related notes. And then she took the penlight torch out of her mouth and explained it all again. So I eventually got the gist of it. Just in time, too, because at that very point the apartment door exploded into splinters by way of a controlled, shaped charge detonation that was apparently the thing a decade ago, and the heavily armed, cyber-enhanced goons returned in force. My rescue at the hands of Chastity Dare, involving desperate leaps from seventh-story windows while, for some abstruse reason, handcuffed together, tightrope walking across vestigial telecommunication and power lines and, at one particularly fraught point, sprinting from a helicopter-mounted thorium-laser-powered skysaw as it bisected Tower Bridge lengthwise, is another story in itself. Suffice it to say, I feel that I carried myself throughout the entire ordeal with a certain quiet dignity and barely wet myself at all. Of similar unimportance, likewise, are the details of my several subsequent years on the run, having adopted as my cover the nom de plume of Miguela Santanini and her music of 1,000 accordions. Though, much as in many aspects, it was akin to the finding of my true calling, it is a personal misfortune that in my persona as Miguela, I tend to come off less madamesque, big band leading Femme Fatale, and more Bernard Breslau dragged up in a carry-on film. Although, come to think of it, I find myself hard-pressed to recall a concrete example of Bernard Breslau dragged up in a carry-on film. I might be thinking of the other one with a face like a bag of spanners who is shorter. The logistical expenses of this enterprise were nothing short of a waking nightmare, incidentally. And attempts to downsize, as it were, if anything, even worse. It's hard enough to find 1,000 accordionists in the first place, let alone 1,000 accordionists all under 5'2" and willing to travel 24 to a packing crate. And of course, crucially, if one has even the slightest consideration for the ultimate sound quality of the performance, the accordions still have to be the same size. In any case, for the most part, we were able to, more or less, keep our heads above water, apart from that unfortunate cargo vessel collision off the coast of Port Merion, with our repertoire of popular standards, such as Weston and Lee's What I Want is a Proper Cup of Coffee, made in a proper copper coffee pot, an all-percussion cover of Mr. Michael Batt's Hall of the Mountain Womble, a surprising feat of musical virtuosity and an experience in and of itself when played on 1,000 accordions, and naturally, our grand finale, The Maracas of Caracas, which goes like this. The maracas and caracas fairly hit you in the smacker, and everyone is having quite the ball. If you really feel the lack of a maraca to the smacker, the maracas of Caracas have it all. And so on. The point is that, quite recently, a recording of the latter song became something of a breakout hit in the international accordion-related world, receiving quite a nice write-up in Accordion Monthly, incorporating Squeezebox Weekly Digest, and achieving a solid number 2 in the accordion-related chart listings of In All Places. And at this point, I must, unfortunately, digress yet again, because you, reading this, will almost certainly be thinking I was going to say the song was a big hit in Caracas. It almost certainly wasn't. But I have no earthly idea if it was or not. I have never been to Caracas, and know nothing about it, save a cursory glance at an encyclopedia entry that liberally throws around terms such as murder capital of the world. Far be it from me to judge such matters, but I suspect the good people of Caracas might be rather too busy for the joys of accordion-related music, however beneficial it might be in some regards, what with all the murders going on. The locale in question was, in fact, completely Maidupistan. And I should straight away explain why I've called it that, if only for the purposes of this preamble. In what passes for reality these days, in this time of misery and strife, it's one of the few republics left in the world that holds on to the hardline Soviet communism of half a century ago. So innately secretive and isolationist that few people knew or cared about its existence, even when the old-style Eastern Bloc was a thing. To give the true name might attract unwelcome attention, not least from the secret police who are still a massively and summarily lethal concern there. At least, by all accounts, they are. I never saw any, which might or might not have been a good sign. In any case, in short, not to beat around the bush and to cut an already almost absurdly long preamble to the bone, the population of the republic in question had by some abstruse means been exposed to the maracas of Caracas, and thought it was the second best thing ever. And if you expect some snarky and reductive comment along the lines of probably because they'd only ever heard Soviet propaganda concerts and or balalaikas, then you little know your man. Let alone the fact that, ultimately, it only came a popular second to my arch-nemesis, Carlo Fandango, and his cavalcade of accordion-playing otters. So, in any event, we were flown out in a quad-propeller plate-armoured aerial transport, blindfolded all the way, in some confusion, and to this day I'm unsure if we were actually at gunpoint or under duress at all, for a series of, so we gathered, state-sanctioned concerts. Carlo Fandango apparently having not been as immediately available and gullible as us. Many and varied were the incidents and adventures attendant on this deplorable state of affairs, but that's a story for another day. The point is that one night, I was relaxing in the admittedly already dilapidated Prospect apartment that had been secured for me during the duration of my stay. I had just doffed my wig and kicked off my slingbacks and was enjoying a bowl of nourishing sour fish gruel that was quite the luxury in those parts, when I espied something odd. There, on the wall, was a section of bricks where the mortar had crumbled over the years, perfectly visible under the last remains of whitewash that had mostly long since flaked. The damage, if such it could be called, was simply due to age and wear. The wall had obviously been in that state, if cumulatively, for years or even decades. But it hadn't been like that for years or even decades the second before. The bricks came out crumbling and easily under my prying fingers. In the cavity beyond, under the spilled light of the apartment's 20-watt bulb, looking as if they'd lain there for years or decades, was a collection of somehow familiar-seeming papers. And my heart leapt. You see, those of us who chronicle the lives and adventures of Bernice Summerfield get our information from quite a variety of sources. Parchment scrolls stuffed into artifacts discovered in ancient vaults, scraps of old Filofax paper seemingly stuffed down the back of sofas and then forgotten about, emails apparently from random cranks, visions beamed directly into one's head while asleep and dreaming. Even being physically transported to the far future and actively told stuff before getting hit with a mind wipe ray and consciously forgetting all about it. Though this has never happened to me. The fact remains that whatever forces and concerns there are in the universe who wish the lives and stories of Bernice Summerfield to be known, they seem to have an extensive, if somewhat inconsistent, control of space, time, and matter. Said information can come from any and all places with no rhyme or reason to their discovery. But certain individuals can see them for what they are and recognize them as the real deal. It was this feeling, a feeling I hadn't felt in years, that I felt when drawing the scraps of paper from their crevice. Unfortunately, it seemed that the secret police had got there first. Possibly in the course of doing whatever nefarious thing it is that the secret police get up to in walls. The sheaf consists of diary pages, personal letters, scribbled notes, hard copy printouts from some future textbook, and what might be the occasional alien language-based promotional flyer, more than half of which was blacked out with heavy blocks of India ink. And since this was the state in which I found it, all other probability states have collapsed, and this is what the thing is with which I am stuck. The censorship, such as it is, doesn't seem to be of anything particularly politically sensitive or salacious. It just seems random. I suspect that it was done reflexively, by whoever did it, purely because that's what the secret policemen do if they have some ink to hand. My initial thought here was to present the source material in facsimile so that you, reading this, could make what you might of it. But then I realised that those with a need to criticise might presume I was being far too artsy and pretentious and clever for my own good. So I'm just going to tell you what happened as best I can make out. And if you feel the above, all of which is scrupulously and meticulously true, is something of a long run-up for a short and disappointing slide, then, well, yes, sometimes life just sucks like that. The planet was Sylvana, and not strictly a planet at all. That is, externally, it was an unremarkable and barren ball of rock, orbiting a sun in the usual course of things. But it was, in fact, a hollow world. The interior was a vast pellucidic cavern, illuminated by a sun suspended in the centre, which pulsed, producing a day-night cycle of roughly 26 hours, so far as time might be recognised on planet Earth. It was clearly, in one sense, artificial, but only in the sense that it was an artefact from the so-called world builders. Those unknowable entities from the bilennia of deep time who had just seemed to like creating stuff, from Dyson spirals around quarks to sustainable and environmentally consistent worlds in the form of a disk. Presumably, just to leave this stuff around and see what happened. In the case of Sylvana, what had happened was that life had emerged, and indeed proliferated. Whether from some seed of spaceborne contamination hitting the surface and working its way in, or the random chemical reactions of elements warmed and or cooled by the pulsing of the sun, life evolved. And the salient point, I gather from what I can make out of the source material, is that said life evolved into a dominant species that was plant-based but otherwise distinctly humaniform. And this was something of a deal when it was discovered in the populated galaxy at large. Apparently there were, are, will be, certain factions who believed, forgive me for ditching all the complications of tenses that come when dealing with futurity and settling on the narrative past, who believed to their very bones, humaniform bones, that this was the natural form with which all life must conform to be considered valid sentient beings, to be people. And the emergence of a new humaniform strain of life with seemingly no outside influence was just meat and drink to them. Speeches were being made. Distressingly orange-hued people were being elected. Riots were kicking off. It was necessary, in short, for those remaining in the galactic community with two neurons to rub together to determine the definitive mechanism by which this phenomenon had occurred. To this end, Benny was deputized as part of what was essentially a quasi-official fact-finding mission. Age is difficult to judge, what with the various restorative factors of time travel and futurity, but she seems older and more experienced than when I last knew of her. I vaguely gather it's possible that she spent some time as galactic president, whatever that actually means in our terms, but it was more complicated than that. In any event, she was received as a visiting dignitary and offered an instant respect, bordering on reverence, to a degree far greater than might be explained by her innate delightfulness. Benny was placed in the charge of a young Sylvanian, who was serving as a combination of cultural attaché and tour guide. Her name was Niala. Slim and female-seeming, very obviously female-seeming in some respects, with olive-green skin, silky to the touch like rose petals, and fern-like hair which she wore in braids. She moved, when she moved, with an easy grace that might have been called willowy, if that wasn't too on the nose, and carried herself with a cheerful serenity such that it was impossible to imagine her ever being cruel or unkind. In her diary extracts, Benny makes a point of saying that she is not the type of person to go chasing after anything that moves. Unlike some people of her general acquaintance, she might add, but she was struck dumb by the instant attraction she felt. She had not felt something with such force for longer than she cared to remember. Indeed, her diary entries go on about this at some length, trying to account for it, wondering if she might be obsessed and so forth, to the point where, frankly, I feel they could have done with more secret police censorship than there is. And as is so often the case when struck dumb, one tends to blurt out the dumbest thing imaginable. "I see your people wear clothes," she blurted, some inner part of her curling up in mortification even as the words came out of her mouth. "I'd have thought you wouldn't need to bother, what with having no, bits." Niala smiled. "We are born of the Tree of Lights, the World Mother, and we share a connection with her, but we are living individuals. We breathe, we eat, we suffer from extreme heat and cold. And as for, bits, we might not procreate precisely in the manner of your kind, but that does not mean we are without the capacity for joy."
"Is that a fact?" said Benny. It was one of those unspoken moments of eye contact that speak volumes too profound for a bog-standard writer like myself to even articulate. So I won't. Likewise, I shall gloss over the wondrous sights Benny saw as Niala led her through the environs and arboreta of Sylvana, the detailing of which would require a book in itself. Suffice it to say that, as day turned to dusk, Benny's attraction only grew and was reciprocated, and at length, in the swirling spindrift light of the World Mother, they kissed. Niala tasted of nectar. And then, of course, one thing led to another. And another. And a quite extensive number of other things, These are related at quite some length and detail in the diary extracts, which for a wonder have escaped the secret police censorship almost entirely. I hesitate to detail them to a family audience, however, because, oh, blimey, they get a bit mucky. Instead, we shall draw a veil over such unpleasantness and skip to the following morning, when Benny arose from her bower to find Niala in a state of distress. Shock, fear and puzzlement flickered on her face in such a manner that it was all Benny could do not to try to magically kiss it away. "I have communed with the mother," Niala told her simply. "We have no intimation of how it might have happened, how it can even be possible. But there is no question. I am with child."
"What?" Benny said.
And on that cliffhanger, which obviously raises all sorts of questions, I have to say those most dreaded of all words, "to be continued." Sorry, but someone has just dropped athletically through the skylight. It's Chastity Dare. Despite all my precautions and obfuscations, it seems the Matraxis breed have discovered my location and heavily armed cyber-assisted goons are on their way even as we speak. Fortuitously, I've been learning the banjo ukulele and have a bulk order on Amazon for just this eventuality. Never fear, though. I shall not rest until every possible fact has been told and every possible question answered. That is, if I...